Chapter Inability to Work. I couldn't go back to work. The work visa was there. The desire was there, burning, because work equaled freedom, and freedom equaled divorce, and divorce equaled salvation. But the agencies that process permits weren't operating. COVID, everything stopped. Paperwork that could have been done in a month stretched to a year. I couldn't do the one thing that separated me from freedom. Get a certificate, a piece of paper, a stamp, permission, as if my whole life came up against someone's desk with no one sitting behind it. And while I waited for that piece of paper, while I counted days and planned the divorce that kept getting postponed, everything around me was getting worse. Arsony became more aggressive, and I couldn't work, couldn't leave, couldn't hide. I was home, around the clock. Without work, without an exit. The walls closed in, days became identical. The body forgot what day it was. Alone with a child who exploded, and with a husband, I walked on eggshells around to prevent his explosions. Arsony screamed, hit, threw, choked. Not from malice, from panic, but I didn't know that yet. The diagnoses wouldn't come for another year. For now, things were only heating up. I screamed back, said, "Leave if you don't like it." In my grandmother's words, in my grandmother's voice. Because in moments of overload, the autopilot switched on, and I became what I'd promised not to become. And I understood that alone I wouldn't cope with my son, like my mother. Alone. That thought, alone like my mother, I won't cope with him, was the most terrifying thought of my life. Scarier than I'll die at 42. Scarier than the balcony of the 17th floor. Because it meant I need help. I need another person beside me. I need Vitya. Not as a husband, as a second adult in the house, as someone beside whom Arsony would grow up with a father, because I knew what it was to grow up without. And that thought killed the divorce plan. Didn't postpone it, killed it. Because leaving meant being alone with a child who gets expelled from everywhere. Being alone, like my mother. My mother didn't cope. She chose the bottle. And I already had a bottle on the kitchen counter. I stayed. From the understanding that a child with these diagnoses wouldn't survive with one parent who was themselves destroyed. That I needed a partner. At least functional, at least present. That there would be no ideal. My son would not search for his father through detectives. My son would know his father, even if that father screams. Even if he looks with contempt. Even if he doesn't know how to love the way the books describe. He would be there, beside him, every day. That was the minimum I could give him. The minimum I never had. I would have to live with Vitya. Not want, not decided, not chose. Would have to. Like having to breathe when the air is bad. Like having to walk when your legs won't hold. I stayed, clenched my teeth, pulled in my stomach, strapped back in, and went to work. Chapter Working at Amazon. I got the certificate, went through 80 interviews in 3 months, practiced on smaller companies, 10 of which were with Amazon. They hired me. I worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Not because they demanded it, because I didn't know any other way. Because work was the only place where I felt competent. Where my skills were worth money. Where my efforts produced results. Where I could solve a problem and get confirmation. You're needed. You're useful. You exist. Everything else in life didn't give that confirmation. At work, I was someone. A product manager. A leader. The person who does the impossible in 8 months. The title I earned at Amazon after my first product release. That same robot machine that doesn't feel, doesn't tire, doesn't cry, just solves problems. There were no feelings, only tasks and endurance. I don't remember good moments from that period. Not because there weren't any, maybe there were, but my defense mechanism erased memories, all of them, good and bad, as if memory decided, if you can't forget only the pain, forget everything, and I forgot, and could be strong again. Because if you don't remember how bad it was, you can pretend it wasn't, and continue, and get up, and go. One more day, 12 more hours, one more problem to solve. This is how I lived. for years, in emergency mode that never switched off because no one was there to press stop. I pulled through. Until it snapped. Back then, I didn't know that snapping isn't the end. It's the beginning. But before the beginning, I had to fall. Iron Man didn't complain. He didn't know how. He worked until he wore out. And wearing out was nothing new for him. Chapter Grandmother in the Body of a Child. It showed up right after the move, as if someone flipped a switch. We had deliberately settled in an expensive neighborhood for the school. Rating 10 out of 10, best in the area. We calculated everything, neighborhood, school, stability. Now we'd finally live like people. Now everything would be like it should. But something in Arseny broke from the move from Toronto. Apparently the stress, new house, new country, new language, new people, was too much. He started exploding. Every day, out of nowhere. Eventually it turned out he has autism, a pathological demand avoidance profile, PDA, and ADHD. But back then, in the first months, we knew nothing yet. We just lived inside his escalating aggression. When I later learned what PDA is, a lot fell into place, but it didn't get easier. PDA means that any demand, even the gentlest, put on your jacket, sit down for homework, time to eat, is perceived by the child's nervous system as an attack, not as a request, not as a rule, as a survival threat. The body triggers fight or flight, and for Arseny, it was fight. Always fight. Panic instantly turned to aggression, screaming, hitting, throwing, breaking, biting, insulting, from age 6, not because he's mean, because he's scared. And ADHD adds impulsivity. The reaction is instant, without pause, without filter, without breaks. The brain doesn't have time to think. The body is already acting. At home, it looked like this. Aggression you couldn't predict. Like weather without a forecast. You don't know when the storm will start. You don't know what will trigger it. He didn't like the food. Screaming. Something didn't work in a game. Screaming and the room trashed. Woke up on the wrong side. Screaming. Insults. Attack. Simply because you're standing nearby. Assault and a grimace of hatred. From 0 to 10 in a second. Without warning, without buildup, without a chance to prepare, like someone fired a gun next to your ear, and you're in shock, frozen, heart pounding, and the brain is trying to understand what happened. And every time I froze, exactly froze, didn't run, didn't fight back, froze from fear, like back then in childhood. Because his scream was my grandmother's scream, identical. The same unexpected, unfair, searing howl from nowhere. The kind you can't get used to, no matter how many years you've lived with it. This was the background of our life for 3.5 years. Constant, daily, relentless. And on the outside at school, another part of the nightmare was unfolding. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. The school called several times a week. Could call in the middle of a workday, in the middle of a meeting. In the middle of a presentation. Pick him up now. I dropped everything and drove. Every time. Listened to the complaints. Apologized. Promised I'd talk to him. Take measures that it wouldn't happen again. Knew it would. Knew tomorrow would be the same call. Knew that after each such conversation, my self-esteem dropped another floor. And there were almost no floors left. Then we found out after the fact about Halloween. Other kids dress up, run around, laugh. Our son was locked alone in a room to protect the other children. A 6-year-old boy locked within 4 walls while the whole world celebrates. Because he's a threat? They didn't even call us. Just decided for us. We learned later. Then there was bullying. School events he wasn't taken to or was taken. And then they called me to pick him up. A school rated 10 out of 10 didn't know what to do with my son. They failed. He was expelled from every camp. Every single one, without exception. The script was identical. First day, an attempt. Second day, a call. Take the child. Never bring him again. I came, apologized, picked him up, heard those words, never again, and every time the same thing rose inside, shame, not for him, for myself, what a bad mother I am, and fears, what if he becomes a criminal, what awaits us in his teenage years if at 6 it's already this, as if it was my fault he's like this, as if I did something wrong, or didn't do, or passed on, or broke. The merciless critic immediately delivered a permanent verdict. It's you. You broke him. You passed it on. You are the continuation of what you ran from. Your fault. And at home, meanwhile, things were getting worse. Arseny was 7 when I didn't give him his tablet and he choked me for it. My child. He threw me out of the house. My son threw me out of my house, the one I paid for. Leave! I don't want you here. You shouldn't be here. And every time I fell into that same 5-year-old girl my grandmother chased outside, threatened with the orphanage. Nobody needs you. And here stands my son saying the same words. And my body hears them not as a child's words. It hears grandmother. I hated him 95% of the time and cried every day. And 5% loved him so much it hurt even more. And then I went back to make up and said it wasn't his fault. And so around and around and around. To endure this, I started drinking. First a little, a glass of wine in the evening, so it would let go, so I'd stop shaking, so I could sleep. Then more. Alcohol became the only way to temporarily not feel, the only way to turn off the endless screaming inside. It became a problem, and I knew it. But knowing and stopping are different things when every day grinds you anew. And then Arseny watched The Matrix. He loved repeating what he saw. Like all kids, only louder, sharper, without a filter, without understanding what's acceptable and what isn't, without sensing the boundary between play and reality, because autism erases that boundary. And the next day at school, he pointed his fingers at the teacher like a gun, like in the movie, and said, "I'll kill you." A small boy repeating a movie scene, not understanding that in America, those words are not a game. In America, after all the school shootings, after all the tragedies, those words are an alarm signal, and the school pushed the button. A police squad came to our house, searched the home, looking for weapons. At our home, a family with an autistic child who pointed his fingers like a gun after watching The Matrix. And I stood there feeling what I'd felt my whole life. This is my fault. I allowed this. I wasn't watching closely enough. I'm a bad mother. And simultaneously, the absurdity. So thick, so viscous. The kind that makes you want to laugh and cry at the same time. My child is autistic. He repeats movies. He's not threatening. He's playing. But the system doesn't distinguish. The system sees words, not context. The system sees a threat, not a boy who doesn't know how else to be. We transferred him to a second school. Already with diagnoses, already with a special plan. IEP, Individualized Education Program, a school considered one of the best in the city for working with children with disabilities. Specialists, protocols, resources, everything by the book. They also failed. Once Arseny was frightened by something. I know this strategy of his. When he's scared, he attacks. Fear turns to aggression instantly, like gasoline igniting from a match. That's his defense, the only one he knows. They started pressuring him, and it got to the point where he started throwing chairs off the second floor. Thank God he didn't kill anyone. They restrained him, called the police. I drove to pick him up. Pulled up to the school and saw 2 huge police cars at the entrance, and I already knew it was about Arseny. I felt it before I saw it, because this wasn't the first time. Because I was already used to that electric jolt in the chest when the school calls. And then I saw a picture impossible to forget. 6 adults holding my 8-year-old son. 6 adults. On one child. My legs gave way. My mouth opened, but there was no scream. Only ringing in my ears. He was curled into a ball. Not screaming. Not thrashing. Frozen. Eyes full of terror. Small. In a ring of 6 adult bodies, and in those eyes, not rage, but the kind of fear that stops your breathing. And I stood watching this, and inside me the same fear rose, and my legs turned to cotton. I had 2 lawsuits because of him, against 2 different schools. The first time because the school caused serious emotional harm, and we even received compensation, $15,000 for therapy, but the damage was already done to the child's psyche. The second, to get him accepted into a specialized school with an ABA program costing $9,000 a month. The district pays, not us, because I proved the previous school caused harm, with lawyers, with evidence. I fought for my child the way I solved everything in life, to the point of burnout. Grandmother taught, fight. My mother showed what happens when you don't fight. I fought, for his place in school, for his future. Never bring him again. Grandmothers don't like it. Leave. Only now about my son. I lived in constant fear. Walking on eggshells. Every morning I woke with anxiety. What kind of day would today be? What would trigger him? What would I do wrong? Where would it blow up? I didn't feel safe, especially with him. I shrank my life to the point where I'm alone. And that's the safest thing I have. I started fearing Arseny would become a criminal. Not because I saw a criminal in him. I saw a boy who was in pain from others' rejection and scared, who didn't know how to express it, who exploded because inside there was no room for quiet. But fear lives separately from knowledge. Fear said, what if? What if his aggression is not a diagnosis but character? What if he grows up and hits like grandmother? Tanya told me, your critic is scaring your parts, telling them Arseny is dangerous. But the danger has passed long ago. Explain this to yourself more often. But explaining and feeling are different things. ABA therapist said, you have to yield and leave. Leave the room. Don't react. Don't escalate. I was told 100 times this is the right strategy. And I set myself up for it. Leave. Just leave. But I couldn't. Leaving meant being thrown out again, like grandmother did. The kitten inside dug in and hissed. I stayed, snapped back, and escalated. And every day the same thing repeated. Here, for example, is our morning. Arseny wakes up and immediately starts screaming. Even though I went to another room to not bother him, because he always screams when you're near him, I needed to sit him down for his programming lesson, and he says, no, I'll do it myself. I don't trust him because he's still lying in bed, and the lesson starts in 5 minutes. He starts screaming again. Now I can't take it and start screaming back. He screams at me, you're a bad mother, you don't love me. And I scream back, go find a better one when you do. Move in with her. He runs out of the house. Vitya calls. I'm sobbing, telling him I hate children, hate Arseny, because everyone screams at me. Grandmother always screamed too. I feel like a child. About 7 years old. And then Vitya starts screaming for me to shut up. Arseny is screaming, Vitya is screaming, and grandmother is screaming, and now I'm screaming from exhaustion by all of it. Hell on earth. Body shaking. Voice gone. In the mirror. Grandmother's face. Then I drive in the car for 30 minutes in silence. Cry with the music up loud so it can't be heard. In dark glasses and with a smile so it can't be seen. Then I come back. Make up. Say it's not his fault. Take the responsibility off him because I'm terrified he'll take the blame on himself, the way I once did, and consider himself bad and unloved. And so, around and around, the hatred evaporates, I go to make up, everything around and around. And then evening comes, and I sit down to write, and the feelings have settled, and the hatred has evaporated again, and once more I don't understand how you can hate someone you love so much. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. I would come to do Arseny's EMDR session the 4th time. We fight every time. Every time he screams. And Vitya, damn it, looks on with displeasure. I hate them all. I just scream back. I hate the family. I hate them all. I have so much hatred. I have nothing good. I even scream throughout the house. Just a scream. Then tears. Then a feeling of hatred for the family. Then Vitya came, took my hand, spoke in a kind voice, and I calmed down quickly, cried a lot, and he said I was being unreasonable, that I should just walk away. And I said, do you know what dissociation is? I don't feel or remember anything after a fight except despair or anger. And then he sees I've been crying by the puffy eyes, doesn't know how to fix things, and starts playing with the blanket, flirting, trying to get me to join his game. That's his way of hoping to make up. And I remember, I did the same thing. Don't remember because I was little, but I know for certain, and I melt slowly. I hated him for the fear, the shame, the police, the lawsuits, the camps, every never bring him again, grandmother's scream from his mouth. And I hated myself for the hatred, and I chose him every time, again and again. Despite the hatred, despite the despair, despite the voice inside screaming, abandon him, leave, like your mother. I didn't leave, didn't abandon, but I also couldn't keep living like this. Chapter Destiny. At exactly this moment, as if the universe decided to test how much more could be placed on this back before it broke, the Destiny story happened. We had an apartment in Toronto. Each of us had sold our property in Novosibirsk, and we had enough for a mortgage in Toronto. When we moved to the U.S., we rented it out. And at some point, a woman named Destiny appeared there. In Russian, sudba, fate, a prostitute, a squatter, a person who moved into someone else's apartment and refused to leave. Fate stole my apartment. Sometimes metaphors are too literal. It sounds like a joke, like a bad comedy script. But when I say refuse to leave, I mean literally. Toronto's laws protect tenants, even if the tenant is a squatter, even if they occupied the apartment illegally, even if there are human feces on the balcony and the doors and cabinets are ripped out because of their actions. She flooded the neighbors. The police took her away for having sex on our balcony and returned her. And I couldn't get into my own apartment. Couldn't. The law, COVID. Courts dragged on. I had to hire lawyers from California, remotely. We lost a lot of money, money we'd saved for years and earned through honest work. When Vicha told me about the situation, I jumped in, instantly, on autopilot, the way I jumped into every problem in my life. Saw a problem, fix it. Didn't ask myself, what do I feel? Didn't ask, do I even have the resources? The robot just switched on, yeah. And took off. I couldn't sleep because of it. Lay down and couldn't close my eyes because revenge scenarios kept playing in my head. How I'd punish this woman. How I'd get the money back. How I'd restore justice. Obsessive thoughts. The kind that don't switch off. That loop like a broken record. She stole what's mine. She stole what's mine. I'm powerless. I can't do anything. Powerlessness. Financial terror. Revenge obsession to the point of lost sleep. Powerlessness. That was the feeling I knew best. Since 6 months. When mother isn't there and you lie unable to even turn over. When grandmother hits and you stand unable to leave. When grandfather doesn't protect and you can't ask. When Vitya screams and you can't answer. Powerlessness was my ambient state. Only I'd learned not to notice it because control was running on top. Control solved problems. Control moved forward. Control created the illusion that I wasn't powerless. And Destiny shattered that illusion. Showed you control nothing. You can't even enter your own apartment. Later in therapy, I would unpack this story and understand two things. First, I was angry at myself for jumping in. For taking on this problem. The way I took on every problem my whole life. And arriving at suicidal depression. Second, I was angry at Vitya for allowing it, for not protecting, not the apartment, but me, for telling me the news and stepping aside, as he always did, while I, as always, jumped in. But that understanding would come later. Back then, I simply didn't sleep, didn't eat, counted losses, and hated a woman whose name, like a cruel joke, meant fate. And this became the second to last straw. Chapter Prison on my birthday. Hello, here's a story about how I wonderfully spent my birthday evening and the entire night in a women's jail. and I actually think it's pretty cool, because it came with a number of benefits I discovered later. But the conditions were brutal, straight out of a movie. It started with me working nonstop, a product launch coming up, working from 7 a.m. until pickup time. On my birthday, I had 2 glasses of wine at 6 p.m. when everything was done. Friends invited me to celebrate, literally next door at the neighboring plaza. Vitya said, "Go, at least you'll see some people." Because I work in this room and live in the same room. Sleep, sit down. I don't see actual living people. If I had felt drunk, I wouldn't have gotten behind the wheel. I was certain I was fine and under the California legal limit of 0.08. I'd driven in that state before. I arrived, didn't drink anything. Talked to Violetta. There's a witness that I didn't drink. Since I had to drive back home to test, I left around 8:30. 8 minutes of driving. And I thought, well, since clubbing isn't happening tonight, I have to work late. I'll just crank the music. Cranked it to maybe 20. I usually listen at 10. That was my first mistake. Because when a person listens to loud music, there are studies on this, they automatically increase their speed. And I, of course, increase my speed, maybe by 15 miles. And it's a small road, lower speed limit than usual. There's a turn. I didn't make the turn. Started braking too late and drove into oncoming traffic. Red light, cars stopped. Braked in front of a motorcyclist. He fell off from fright. I didn't touch him, obviously. But I'd probably have soiled my pants too if a car like mine braked in front of me like that. About a meter between us, I got out and started apologizing. He says, "You ruined my whole bike." But he just jumped off it right in front of my eyes and dropped it on its side. My next mistake, I started arguing with him. Said, "First of all, I didn't exactly ruin it. You jumped off it yourself." That, naturally, was already making him angry. Next mistake. I'd never been in an accident. Don't know what to do in these situations. I think, need to call the cops. But he says, "Let's just do this quickly. I need to go. Give me your license and insurance." Turns out you just let each other photograph it, then file with insurance. And that's it. He was ready to leave immediately. He was in a hurry. No. I say, "Why should I give you my documents? Call the cops. Asked for it myself." Vitya on the phone said, "What are you doing? You should have just given the documents." The cops came. The motorcyclist was fine. Says, not hurt. I recorded video showing the bike was far. But I smell of alcohol, obviously. Do all our tests, they say. I did the test well. Even showed them burpees. It was cold. Wanted to warm up. December evening already. Because later, when they were already driving me to jail, the officer, he treated me very kindly. I said, "I was ready to let you go." Tests were fine. The smell bothered me. And he asked me to do one last thing. Blow into a tube. The tube showed bad news, over the limit. And that was it. Protocol requires them to take you for an official test. Because that tube can be inaccurate. They put handcuffs on me. I couldn't believe this was actually happening. It was like a movie. He put on handcuffs and says, "We're going to take you to a women's detention facility. Run the test. Worst case, fingerprints, database check that you're not a criminal. 6 hours max, and we'll let you go." We arrive. I'm sitting in a car with bars like in a movie. He could see I was very cooperative, that I'd do the test fine, that I wasn't drunk. Thought they'd probably release me right away. That the test would be under 0.08. He didn't put my car on a tow truck. That would have cost me $1,500. Just went out of his way. I didn't ask. Then while driving, we chatted. I told him I can't believe all this is happening to me. That it's my birthday, that I'm working. That I have a ton of tests to run tonight. That I'd just turned the music up louder. He told me about his wife, also an overachiever. When any test is below 97 points, she's very upset. We joked on the way. They brought me in, I blew into the license machine. First time, 0.06. They say, "Let's do it again." Blew again, 0.08. And here was my biggest mistake. I should have said, redo the test, because I didn't feel like I had any alcohol at all. Well, I did, obviously. At 0.06, I would have passed and been released. But I didn't say it. He says, "That's it, I can't help you anymore. Women's jail for you. They'll take fingerprints, run the database check, and send you home." He brings me into this space, the entrance. I'm still in handcuffs. Hands are pretty numb. It's already 11 at night. Everything about this is not optimal. First a photo, then talk to a doctor. About whether you're planning to kill yourself. I don't know why they asked that. They also made me sign documents without reading them. 3 signatures. Maybe I sold a kidney. Also a lesson for the future. Don't sign anything you haven't even been shown. You talk through a little window. They took my phone, watch, ring, all jewelry. Everything. Gave nothing back. Next, the next room, fingerprints. The women look me over with such thoroughness. No man has ever examined me with such attention. There was an x-ray to check that no knife is hidden in secret places. They took my jacket, left in a t-shirt, jeans, took my shoes, took my socks. Gave me some thin, not even paper, but rubber slippers that slide. Sat me on an iron chair in the middle of the room. Can't stand up. When you try to stand, they yell, "Sit!" in this terrifying voice. Bathroom with an open door. Yes, like that. When I stood up to stretch my arms, they told me, "Sit," I said. My shoulders are numb. He then removed one handcuff and cuffed me to the chair. And this was him going out of his way for me, as I later understood. He was actually really very kind to me, understood the situation. And the most brutal thing, it's maybe 15 degrees Celsius, maximum. While I'm in just a t-shirt and jeans, I'm sitting there, literally shaking. I later joked with the girls that at least I was losing weight, because I'd recently listened to Huberman. He said, this is a very effective method, these micro-shakings, when you burn a ton of calories. Burned calories all night. Can't stand up, can't walk. By the end, my legs were literally blue. Not joking. The fact that they yelled at us, spoke rudely. That's like in the movies. I wasn't too surprised there. Oh, and there was crazy lady. Really, some very... This woman had mental health issues. They brought her in. She showered the officer who brought her with insults. And that officer remarkably maintained very respectful treatment. 40 minutes of continuous insults. That's very hard in general. I don't know why they developed such armor. Because not everyone is as nice as me. By the time all this was done, already 1:30 a.m., checked the fingerprints. At 2, they told me, "You're free, you can go. But we won't give your things back. Someone has to come for you. From 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. We don't release people. Unsafe. Someone has to drive in. Wait in line. Call. Uber? No, can't. They won't give back the phone, even though they released you." Vicio was peacefully asleep. He has do not disturb mode, like me. We have each other set, so calls go through. If I'd called from my phone, he would have heard. But from the jail phone, hidden number. The call isn't confidential. You wait a long time to be connected. Like an Orange Is the New Black. An awesome show. And I experienced it on my own skin. I called, maybe 15 times. Asked other girls who were ordering bail to call from their numbers. Thought repeated calls would work. Didn't work at all. He blissfully slept until 5:30. The shift changed, new woman. And I have Vitya on the line. Need to tell him where to go. But I don't know. Nobody explained where I am. Other than that it's a jail. And there might be many. Female detention facility, it's called. In Russian, prison. I call Vitya, say, "I'll find out the address now." But you can't approach them, these women at the window. They immediately, apparently used to harden people, tense up, yell, "Sit. Back to your spot." You even have to sit a certain way. It's exactly like this. I'm sitting with my arm extended, waiting for someone to come. This new woman comes. Beautiful woman, she even has these cool eyelashes. But when she starts talking, not beautiful, sees I'm asking that a phone is waiting. No. I tried to approach. she yelled at me. Hard. Those voices are familiar to me. She's just brutal. Then she comes over. Vicha has been waiting this whole time. At 6 a.m., she spent 10 minutes doing her makeup, comes over, and in this horrible voice says, "And what, you couldn't wait 5 seconds? I say, "I need the address so my husband can come. I was released a long time ago since 2 a.m. I need someone to pick me up." She, "I don't know you. I just got here. You're nobody to me. Sit and wait." With great difficulty, I explained, asked politely, apologized. "Please just give me the name at least, where to drive." "He'll Google it." She quickly barked the name. Vicha arrived with Arseny around 6:30, then waited until past 8. "Though they told me, at 7 it'll happen, they'll release you right away because you're already clear. Nobody starts working on time there. All these processes are horribly inefficient. The whole thing is designed to torture people. That's how I'd put it." During the wait, they came twice and said, "Line up, everyone stand, line up, and put us in a cell." I say, "Why a cell?" "I've already been released." They say, "That's how it is." The first shift was nicer. They knew about my birthday, maybe that's why. Said, "There's just a person coming whom you're not allowed to see." I don't know who that was. In this cell, I met Olya, a Russian woman, older, driving on a small road, residential area, 15 miles per hour, and someone throws themselves right in front of the car. Not right under the wheels, about 2 meters, enough to break, but enough to call the police. The person was invisible, all in a hood. Then police appear from somewhere. She was arrested, told nothing about this person. Bail, $100,000. 10 in cash immediately. Otherwise, you sit 5 days until court. I'd already heard about this scheme. A way to get American citizenship. They pick a car barely moving, jump, know how and at what distance so they won't get hit, and calmly get citizenship. And now she has all this. I felt sorry for this woman. No reason not to believe her. At least someone gets something good. The person gets citizenship. This bail thing, it's a business. In any jail, probably. They constantly talk about this bail. Have you contacted a bail agent? Is bail ranged? And though you can't stand up, if you're going to call about bail, you can. Huge lists hang in there. Tons of bail offices you can call and get a sort of mortgage that you'll pay for the rest of your life. $250 a month. If you have $100,000, just right for a lifetime. There were 4 of us girls overnight. 2, like me, had a little to drink. 2, serious cases, had to get bail. I saw myself from a new angle, after working from home. I was joking there, talking. It was actually pretty fun for me. Realized how much I miss people. Something to remember in old age. When they finally let us out onto the street, barefoot in rubber slippers, 5 degrees in the morning, we shuffled down the street for 7 minutes in those sliding slippers with blue legs. I thought one thing. The greatest happiness in life is simply a hot bath. Making a person happy is simple. Take everything away, then give back a little. I genuinely felt bliss when I just got in the car and turned on the heater. Benefits. My love for my husband grew exponentially. Immediately. Because he, first of all, didn't scream at me when I called him crying from the crime scene, came to pick me up from that hellhole, was understanding, though he'd never had a run-in with the police. And he always follows the rules, unlike some people. We have this rule here. When you drive through a residential area, there are stops, where you're required to come to a complete stop and only then drive. And so endlessly, they'll stop, drive, stop, drive, and there are no cars. I never followed this rule. And now, thanks to having a DUI, I'll have to be super exemplary for 10 years. I'm not allowed a single gram of alcohol behind the wheel. For the next 10 years, I'll follow every rule. Stops and right turns with a full stop I'll have to observe. That's my minimum goal. And the maximum. I'd really like to not drink at all. I'll try to use this as leverage. For Arseny, it was a good lesson. In our family, we honestly tell each other how things are. I asked Vicha to tell him the truth. were going to pick up Mom from jail for drunk driving. She broke the rules. When I was released, I told him everything in detail, what happened to me and why I was taken. That because of a small violation, I spent the whole night behind bars. And for a big one, a person can spend their whole life. And for him, as a person who loves to break rules, well, he's my son, it's useful to know this. And for that version of me who will someday reread this, please remember how you felt there and about the possible consequences that I really could have killed a person, and then I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be sitting somewhere else. Hello from the past. About the consequences. Insurance will go up a lot. For 6 months, I'll drive with a tube in the car. Blow every time for it to start. This thing checks that there's zero in the blood. I'll attend some school for several months where they brainwash you. And also court, where worst case, 3 months behind bars. But if I hire a lawyer for $5,000 to $15,000 because I'm planning to contest this case, that machine showed 0.06 one time and 0.08 another. If it's 0.06, they should have let me go. Planning to contest so the consequences aren't as serious. So that's the fun, sad birthday experience. In the end, I contested and just drove with the tube and got the brainwashing. No, this story was not about the last straw. Chapter Losing My Job. This had already happened before, exactly the same, like a broken record. In Toronto, I worked at a company called Viana. Through myself, in the way I always did, 12 hours, to the point of burnout, with that same perfectionism that instead of good, produced only perfect or death, released a product, got the company award, Shining Star Award, top performer who inspires others. And then the company went bankrupt during COVID, laid off, thank you, goodbye, and A in the diary. And they ripped the diary up. The second seminar, the second dispensa, was the turning point. Not because of meditations, because of people. The two who told me about AA and breathing, they showed direction. Dispensa gave context. But doing it, I had to do myself. The second seminar, the second dispensa, was the turning point. Not because of meditation, because of people. The two who told me about AA and breathing, they showed direction. Dispensa gave context, but doing it, I had to do myself. And now, Amazon. For 8 months, I worked on a project my manager would later call, never happened, impossible. No one before me could do it, it's impossible, and she did it. I worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, sleepless, between Arseny's screams and Vitya's silence, between lawsuits for the child and calls from school, pick up your kid, and meetings where I was that same robot machine, a super AI chat GPT that doesn't feel, doesn't tire, doesn't cry, just solves problems. Release the product. God exceeds high bar. Amazon's highest rating. And then they laid me off, like at Viana, word for word, scene for scene, same script, do the impossible, lose everything. Invest maximum, get zero, twice in a row, at two different companies, in two different countries, as if life was testing. Do you see it? Do you see the pattern? Back then I didn't see the pattern, I only saw ashes. The formula confirmed itself once more, no matter how much you do, they'll discard you. You are a resource. Used and forgotten. The last straw. The phoenix didn't rise. Inside, emptiness. After that, the suicidal depression began. Not the kind after my mother's death. That was about numbness. About insomnia. About a body that doesn't sleep. This was different. This was about a black hole you fall into with nothing to grab. 2 years. 2 years of depression that wasn't helped by pills, therapy, ketamine, or mushrooms. 2 years during which the only thing keeping me on this side was Arseny, obligation, a mother's duty, a decision made long ago. My child will not grow up without a mother. Chapter Suicidal Period. 2 years of suicidal depression. Not 2 years of sadness, not 2 years of, I feel bad. 2 years of living at the bottom, where there's no light, no air, no reason to get up in the morning, sleeping, relaxing, feeling joy, and experiencing pleasure. These four things were inaccessible to me. All four. As if someone cut from life everything worth living for and left only pain, duties, and insomnia. I constantly thought about how to kill myself. Not abstractly, concretely. With details. With calculation, like everything in my life. Sometimes these thoughts came as a plan. Cold, logical, the head computing options. Sometimes, as a scream from the place that was so wounded, it simply wanted it to stop. But most often they came out of spite toward Arseny. The suicidal part no longer came to visit. She moved in, lived with me every day, simply waited for me to agree. I would later understand. She too was trying to help. The pain that couldn't be endured consciously, she offered to end, cruelly, but in her own way, out of care. Not the method, but the motive. Not a desire for death, a desire for it to stop. Arseny screamed at me. His scream hit the same spot as my grandmother's, and I instantly turned not into a mother, but into a 7-year-old girl standing in a corner wanting to die. His words, "You're a bad mother, you don't love me," were grandmother's words in a different voice. And in response to that scream, from the depths, from the place I usually didn't let reach the surface, rose, I'll die, and you won't have a mother. Like me, you'll learn what that's like. That was the most terrifying thing I could think, the most shameful, because it was exactly what was done to me. My grandmother said, "You'll die under a fence," and I believed. My mother died, and I grew up with guilt. Now I myself, in my suicidal fantasies, was doing the same to my child, using my death as a weapon, as revenge, as punishment for his screaming, for the fact that because of him I stayed with Vitya, for the fact that he has parents, both, and I had none. And yet, through all of this, I took out life insurance, not on myself, on Vitya, deliberately, consciously, so that when I killed myself, they'd have money, so my death wouldn't be for nothing, so that even dying I'd be useful. Even my own death I planned as a project, with a budget, a beneficiary, a return on investment calculation. The perfectionist worked to the very end, even death, as a project. Why live if pain isn't compensated by joy? But somewhere at the very bottom, where there's no more hope, no plan, no phoenix, I noticed something. I was still breathing. Not because I wanted to. Not because I chose to. Just breathing. And this just breathing turned out to be stronger than any decision. The body, which I'd forced to be silent for 40 years, it didn't want to die. It wanted to live, even when I didn't. Chapter the husband gave me a knife. We had both been drinking wine, my habitual painkiller, my mother's method, the one she died from. Vitya was also drinking that evening. I was in despair, not the usual ambient kind I'd lived with for years, but the acute cutting kind that comes when the last wall inside collapses. I told Vitya I wanted to kill myself, out loud. Not for the first time. I'd told him before, about the insurance, about not wanting to live. But he didn't believe me, or believed and didn't know what to do with it. He gave me a knife. While drunk, as a provocation, as the gesture of a person tired of hearing the same thing and not believing it's real. Here's a knife. Go ahead. As if wanting to prove, to himself or to me, that I wouldn't do it. That it was just another hysteria that would pass. He didn't understand. Didn't understand that the second the knife was in my hand, what happened inside wasn't sobering up. Not fear, but confirmation. Confirmation of everything I thought about myself. Unneeded. Worthless. A person who was given a knife. Because her life isn't worth fighting for. My mother figuratively plunged a knife into my heart by leaving, by dying. And he gave a real one. Into my hands. And in that drunken, thoughtless gesture, everything converged. My entire childhood. every person who was nearby and didn't protect. I slashed my arm, but Vitya grabbed the knife in time at the last moment, like on the balcony of the 17th floor when he woke up that night. Every time, at the last second, every time, when it's almost too late. He didn't know how to come earlier, didn't know how to be present before it became unbearable. But at the moment of catastrophe, he came, grabbed, and disappeared back into his silence. I hated him for that knife. Still do. With the part that was in the kitchen with a blade at her wrist, he acted like my mother. Didn't protect when protection was needed. But another part, the one writing this book now, sees something else. That Vitya was also drunk, also in despair, also didn't know what to do with a woman who says every day she wants to die. That he's not a villain. He's simply a person who grew up in a house where no one taught him to handle someone else's pain. Like I grew up in a house where no one taught me to handle my own. Two people who didn't know how, and a knife between them. This wasn't the bottom. There was still further to go. But this was the point after which I stopped believing someone from the outside could save me. And then, from this, no one is coming. The only possibility began to sprout. Maybe me. Not strong, not ready. Just the only one left. Body practices, not the ones that didn't help. Chiropractor physical therapy, but the ones that came later when the body started waking up. Osteopath Yulia, life coach and yoga. Alina, singing, a voice clenched since childhood. Olya, body dynamics. Daily exercises, foot, pelvis, sacrum. Building a body map. All of this only worked after breathing and meditation strengthened the core. Before that, like building walls without a foundation. Chapter Mushrooms, MDMA, and the kind voice. When the suicidal depression became my permanent state rather than a visiting one, I started reading everything I could get my hands on. Not for growth, not from curiosity, like a drowning person grabbing whatever's nearby. And I came across mushrooms, psilocybin, research, articles, people who said it helped. And I thought, what do I have to lose? I was already losing everything. I had about 8 journeys. Heroic doses, that's what they call it when the dose is large and you don't control where it takes you. Vitya was my sitter every time. Sat beside me, made sure I didn't harm myself. Not a therapist, a husband. There was no other option. 8 times. He sat beside me 8 times while I died. Screamed, cried, said terrible things. Didn't leave once. Endured. Didn't understand what to do, but stayed. For a person who also wasn't taught to be present with someone else's pain, that was a lot. In the first trips, I was able to truly cry for the first time in my life. Not the kind you cry from exhaustion or from a fight, but from that place that had been closed for 30 years. The place where my mother lived. I cried so much there, it seemed like I was catching up on 40 accumulated years. Grandmother never surfaced, not in a single trip. Only my mother. Gut-wrenching pain for her. Sadness so enormous you could drown in it. And also, fear of death. The feeling that I'd die soon. That I needed help. I said it aloud, in the trip. Start helping me, please. Someone. 10 years before, I'd been working on my mother through constellation therapy. Forgiving. Understanding. Accepting. I thought I'd processed everything. Until I ate the mushrooms. And discovered the inside was full of hatred. Unacknowledged. Unheard. The kind that at 21 my first therapist had forbidden me to feel when she said, "What do you have so many complaints about? She gave you life." And I obediently spent 10 years on forgiveness, skipping over hatred like a step that doesn't exist. The mushroom showed. The step exists. And on it. Me, in terror and rage, since 6 months old. 10 years I leapt over the hatred for my mother. The mushroom sat me back down on that step. Then the convulsions started during trips, so strong that the last time I did mushrooms, I nearly died for real. The body clenched and wouldn't release, and I couldn't breathe through it. I thought it would crush my internal organs. Vitya revived me in a bathtub of boiling water. The mushrooms tried to remove the corset in one yank. The body couldn't take it. Later, they told me in a trip, "This is the last time. Next time you'll die. If you want to die, just eat mushrooms." Through mushrooms, I learned many suppressed feelings. Pain toward my mother, devastation, fear I didn't know about, hatred I'd hidden behind forgiveness for 10 years. And one more thing, the understanding that I needed to create love from nothing, that no one would give it, that no one would bring it, that I'd have to grow it myself, like Munchausen pulling himself by the hair. But mushrooms didn't give a lasting result. The trip ended and everything returned, like a window into normal life. You see the landscape but can't step outside. After the knife, I tried MDMA. We agreed with Vitya. Take it, go to separate rooms, put on masks, listen to music, come together in an hour and a half, when each has understood something about themselves. The substance hit me first, and I did what I hadn't planned. I told Vitya I was going to commit suicide, that everything was ready, the will, the insurance, that I wished him well finding a woman who would care for Arseny. He listened, then stood up, silently, and left the room. Not a word. That's the support I received. The only person nearby stood and left, like grandfather to the garage when grandmother beat me, like mother down the dark street, not turning around. I was left alone, with photos of my grandmother I'd prepared in advance, looked at them and said aloud, "Done. You burned it all. Nothing's left. No love. I'll definitely die." And with that complete resignation, not despair, but resignation, which is worse because it doesn't even have the energy for a scream, I lay on the floor and held my own cheeks with my palms like a child takes herself, two small palms on her face, and started speaking in a thin, childlike voice about how grandmother had burned everything, about how nothing was left. And then, from the same body, from the same hands on cheeks, another voice appeared. Not grandmother's, not the critic's, not my usual one. Different, kind, warm, which said, "No, you matter to me. I don't want you to leave." The voices switched, like a dialogue between two people in one body. The child said, "Grandmother burned everything." The voice answered, "No, not everything." The child, "Nothing's left." The voice, "I'm left." The child, "No one will come?" The voice, "I'm already here." The voices changed physically and I couldn't control it. Just listened from the side. I knew the method. IFS, Internal Family Systems, had read Richard Schwartz's book, knew how it works in theory, parts, self, calm, curiosity, compassion. But theory is one thing. Lying on the floor with palms on your cheeks and hearing for the first time in your life a voice that doesn't insult or blame from inside, that's another. Then Vitya came, said, "I realize that I scream, but I don't know what to do about it." I answered, "Well, I don't know either. I eat mushrooms." He thought, said, "Okay, I'll try too." And he tried. And changes began in him. Strong. Noticeable. The relationship started slowly shifting. Not because one of us suddenly learned to love, but because both began looking inside. But the kind voice existed only under MDMA. In ordinary life, I couldn't hear it. Eyes closed. Darkness, the critic. "You're defective." The voice came with the substance and left with the substance. And then the thing I hadn't prepared for happened. It was Arseny's birthday, 8 years old. His friend was sleeping over, and in the morning I was folding the sofa back together. Felt something stuck inside the mechanism. Thought, trash. A toy caught. Pushed harder. The sofa folded. By evening I noticed the cat was nowhere. Fantique. Arseny's cat. A service cat. A cat dog who endured anything. A dream cat. I searched the whole apartment. Called. checked under beds, behind closets, in the bathroom, then checked the sofa. He was there, in a hole in the mechanism I didn't know about, hidden, the way cats hide, in the tightest, darkest place, and I crushed him, pushed and felt resistance, but couldn't even imagine it wasn't trash but a living creature. I found him myself, dead, on my son's birthday. I killed my son's best friend. I collapsed. Not hysteria. Collapse. Guilt so total I wanted to stop existing. I killed a living creature, my child's cat, with my own hands, the same hands that petted him. And at that moment, without MDMA, without mushrooms, without music, without a mask, without anything, I heard it. The kind voice, the same one. It said, "You didn't do it on purpose. I'm with you. Yes, it's a tragedy. But you didn't do it on purpose." For the first time, from an ordinary state, from the very bottom, from the most terrible place, the voice came on its own, without chemicals. It just came. As if what it needed wasn't a dose, but real grief. As if it had been waiting for the moment when all defenses fell. And finally, finally, it could get through. From that day, I began growing it. Every day. The way you grow a child. Patiently, clumsily, with mistakes. Every morning, when the critic was already running at full power, I searched for the other voice. The one I use with the cat when she scratches, but I love her anyway. Later, much later in the car, I was driving and crying from the realization that a normal family wouldn't happen. And the voice said, "You have a mama inside." I asked like a child, "Why didn't you talk to me before?" The answer came slowly. "You were in such bad shape, you were constantly distracting yourself from the pain. You couldn't look inside. There was no chance, but I was always here, since birth." Every child has the right to love inside. My mother's name was Lyubov. Love. She didn't give what the name promised. But inside, it turned out, there was another one. The one who doesn't leave. Doesn't die. Doesn't choose the bottle. Infinite. Quiet. Who waited 40 years for me to stop screaming and finally listen? The kind voice. For the first time in 40 years. Not someone else's. Not from a book. Not therapeutic. Mine. Quiet, uncertain, like a sprout pushing through asphalt. It said, "Sunshine." And I cried. Not from pain. From the fact that this word is even possible. I remember two things from that evening. The knife going into my arm. And his face when he grabbed it. Not angry. Frightened. Like a person who just realized what he'd done. But it was too late. We never talked about it after. Not once. As if it didn't happen. The way we didn't talk about anything that mattered. The scar stayed. The silence stayed. And between them, 12 more years of marriage. Chapter Big Bear. In October, we went as a family to Big Bear, a mountain resort 4 hours from San Diego, a rental cabin, trails, pines, silence. We were climbing a trail. Vitya started saying something displeased, and I felt it would lead to a fight. I asked, "I can't talk right now. I need a pause." He didn't stop and got even more wound up with criticism. "Please, take a break. I can't listen to this right now. Please." He continued, and I couldn't take it. I screamed, "I hate you, and I want a divorce." And ran, alone, through the forest. Evening, getting dark. Without a phone, not knowing the way, and I get lost even with a GPS. Ran down the trail, turned the wrong way, lost the trail, found another, got lost. Big Bear is a mountain, forest. Bears in the very name, and maybe not only in the name. Evening, alone, no signal. Somehow I got out, found a trail, reached the cabin. Nothing ate me, not the bear. Not the forest, not the darkness. Chapter Munchausen. Munchausen was still pulling, by the last hairs from the last swamp. I went to Joe Dispenza, spontaneously. Without a plan, without preparation. Just went, like a person drowning who grabs at anything. I didn't know who Dispenza was. Well, I knew a little from videos, from motivational clips YouTube served during sleepless nights, but I hadn't read his books yet. But something pushed me to go to a 7-day seminar. Not the head. The head was broken. Something else. The part that at 14 hung from a branch, and the branch broke. She's not loud, just stubborn. I ended up in a hall full of people who were meditating, crying, laughing, feeling things. I sat among them and felt nothing. Closed my eyes, darkness, tried to relax. The body didn't know how. But I encountered the practice, not the idea of meditation. I'd known that for a long time. But the daily sitting, with closed eyes, with an attempt to ask, not solve, not control, but ask for joy, for love, for sensations in the body, for a girl who was forbidden to ask since age 5. This was a revolution. 6 months I meditated every day, asked for only one thing, joy, love, sensations in the body, and felt nothing, nothing. Sometimes emptiness, sometimes tension, sometimes the thought that I'm doing everything wrong. But I continued, not because it was better, because the alternative was clear. On the outside, nothing was happening. No insights, no breakthroughs, no tears of relief. If someone had asked me then whether it helped, I'd have said no. But the body kept sitting down every morning, and somewhere at the edge, not in the head, not in words, something strange appeared. Not even a thought, more like a shift. I suddenly understood that I didn't have to stay. Not in the global sense, not leave life, but simply not be where it's terrifying. Not sleep in a house where at any second screaming can start, not wait for it to begin. For the first time between two habitual points, endure and die, a third appeared. You can leave and stay alive. I don't know when exactly it started. It wasn't a decision, wasn't a thought you can write down. More like water moving under ice. Where I'd stopped breathing many years ago, something barely perceptibly shifted. Quietly, almost invisibly, without permission. As if inside me was a part that hadn't died this whole time. Just waited. This is how my snake woke up. Slowly, without noise, without promises. Coiled in the body, in the place I hadn't breathed into for 40 years, where neither words nor therapy nor attempts to understand reached. Kundalini yoga every morning tried to reach her. Most of the time, nothing, empty, like knocking on a closed door. But sometimes something stirred. Not a feeling, not relief, just movement. As if under the crust of ice there really is water. Snake was in no hurry. She didn't need faster. She didn't need a result. She'd waited many years and could wait more. And for the first time in all that time, I stopped rushing her. In Big Bear, I expected a reset. Fresh air, mountains, distance from the apartment where walls were closing in. Instead, I got the opposite. Ficcio was tense. Arseny was explosive. And I had nowhere to run. In the city, I could drive. Here, trapped. The trip ended early. We packed in silence, drove home without speaking. The mountains didn't help. Nothing outside helps when the problem is inside. Chapter the Cell. I'm a sociable person who locked herself in this apartment all alone, and I like it. I moved out after the Big Bear story, not only because of Vitya's rejection, criticism, screaming, and devaluing. Not only because with him I felt invisible, unneeded, a resource. I moved out because I lived in constant fear, because of Arseny, too. Because of that scream you can't predict and can't understand. Because of that feeling of prison. This is like grandmother. This is fucking forever. Because of this body that every second expects a blow. I rented an apartment 5 minutes from our house. 6-month lease. Took with me 2 forks, 2 spoons, and all my dresses. Furnished it like a monk's quarters. Minimal things. Empty space. Silence. Vitya creates coziness, fancy touches, little comforts. I couldn't care less. I can live without that. I genuinely just need lots of empty space and silence and minimalism. A cell. Before moving, I had paralysis, strong fear in the body. What I found, it might be noisy from the road. On Facebook, it looked a lot like a scam. And when I looked at options far from home, paralyzing fear. Tanya said, separation anxiety. You have to live through it. Survive it with the body. Don't rush. Since you've made the decision, move forward in contact with yourself. I moved, found the apartment, signed the contract, moved in, for the first time in a long while. Quiet? Vitya stayed with Arseny, alone, for almost a year, with a child who screams, hits, explodes out of nowhere, without a wife, without help, worked full-time and then came home to what I'd fled from. He didn't complain, not once. When I asked how are things and he said, fine. His fine was the same lie as my smile and slack. At first I thought I'd go on dates. Why not a free woman living alone have the right? Installed Tinder, scrolled through profiles, swiped right, got matches, and sabotaged absolutely all of them. Even if it got to a date, I didn't go. Couldn't drag myself out of the house without a reason. Going somewhere just because, not for business, impossible. I'm wasting fucking time, and it's scary, too. Elena, my therapist, said I needed to go on these dates. Otherwise, I'm reinforcing the punishing critic who scares me that it's always been bad, is and will be, and I'm not getting the most important thing, a healthy experience where that's not the case. I saw sense in this, but I didn't have the resources for it. I understood. I'm attracted to the same cold, indifferent type as Vitya, and what for? It's a ton of time. Going on these dates, spending it. I knew why I sabotaged. In one of the sessions, in an altered state, I saw it crystal clear. I want to be with my family. I love them very much. That's why I don't go on any dates. Not because it's scary, not because I don't have time. Because I don't want someone else. I want my own. And I dropped the whole idea. Decided, okay, I'll live like this. Without relationships, without sex, alone. I did everything I could. Meditations, therapy, work, and child 50-50. I truly believe that if I did enough, it would get easier. But it didn't get easier. I was sinking deeper. And at some point, this brought me to a place I never thought I could reach. Chapter Kitchen Knife. After Dispenza, at home, everything was the same. The same small apartment, the cell, the same walls, the same silence. Not calm, empty. I stood in the kitchen, alone, had just released a product at ServiceNow, and a knife on the table, not Vitya's. Mine. Just a knife. A kitchen knife. The one I used to cut bread. Only this time I looked at it differently. The first time, when Vitya gave it, was about despair. About the abyss you fall into with someone nearby who doesn't catch you. That time was about two people. This time was about one. Only about me. Standing in the kitchen. No one there. No one provoking. No one screaming. No one given the knife. It's just lying there. And the hand reaches on its own. Not from anger. Not from resentment. From exhaustion. From emptiness. Heavy hands. Empty head. Body not resisting. I picked up the knife. And at that moment, in that second when the metal was at my arm, everything compressed into a single point, not before my eyes. In my body. Grandmother's beatings. Mother's absence. Grandfather's receiver, which he hung up. Maxime, whom I left. Vitya, who screamed, went silent, gave the knife. Arseny, who attacked with scissors. Toronto, California. The balcony. The floor where I lay while the baby crawled. The product I released. A never happened, impossible, and laid off. The insurance policy and the husband's name. Candles on my 30th birthday. The letter to Arseny. If I'm gone to eat, don't take it personally. All of it. in 1 second, in one knife, in one hand, raised it over the vein. A call from a friend. And I stopped, not because I was scared, not because someone grabbed it, not because the branch broke like at 14. I stopped because from inside a word rose, one, quiet, from the belly, not the head, from the part of me that at 6 months lay in a crib, abandoned and didn't die, that at 14 hung from a branch and the branch broke, that stood on the edge of the 17th floor balcony and Vitya woke up, that lived in hell for 2 years and got up every morning, the part that doesn't want to die, that never wanted to, that was simply tired of living the way she'd been living. Maybe this part is the soul. She said, enough. Not enough living. Enough. Like this. Enough enduring. Enough staying silent. Enough being convenient, useful, functional. Enough solving other people's problems. Enough wearing the corset. Enough. This was the very bottom you push off from. Not beautiful. Not poetic. Kitchen, nighttime, knife on the table, ugly, shameful, real. This is where the book began. From this kitchen, from this knife, from this second when I stood between one more attempt at living and all. And I chose not life. I chose to try one more time. One last backup plan. Instead of everything else, myself as a project. Not for someone, for me. This was a beginning, clumsy, shameful, but a beginning, the very one this book was worth writing for. Chapter 2, Strangers. Then came the second Dispenza seminar, February 2025, and there I met two people who changed everything. Not therapists, not gurus, just two people. The first told me about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and said one phrase that was key for me. You don't have to believe in God there. My relationship with God wasn't, I don't believe. Worse, a conflict, since childhood. As a child, I found myself an explanation. The only one that kept me from going mad from what was happening. My soul chose this. Chose it itself. This family, this grandmother, this pain. To learn something. To become stronger. To pass a lesson that couldn't be passed otherwise. This explanation kept me afloat, like a raft of rotting boards, not beautiful, not reliable, but you're on it, and you're not drowning. If the soul chose, it has meaning. It wasn't for nothing. You can endure. And at the same time, on a different floor and the same child, lived something else. My grandmother was religious, prayed, made me recite prayers, and I watched her. A woman who prays and beats, prays and curses, prays and puts you on your knees on buckwheat, and drew my own conclusions. She didn't say God punished you. I decided that myself, because there was no other explanation. If God exists, and grandmother prays to him, and does to me what she does, then God is on her side. Then I'm bad. Then I deserved it. He sees everything. The beating. The expulsion, the corner, and doesn't intervene, watches and doesn't help. What's the point of asking him for help? He never helped me, saw everything and didn't help. God didn't save my mother either, didn't take the bottle from her hands, didn't bring her home. In my world, God stood on the side of those who hit, or he didn't exist at all. Two beliefs live side by side without conflicting, as happens with children, who simultaneously believe in Santa Claus and know that gifts are bought by mom. The soul chose this experience, and God punished me for being bad. One gave hope, the other gave explanation. Both were needed to survive. Then in the 7th month of pregnancy, the first raft fell apart. When I stood with a growing belly and couldn't buy the baby a single thing, when that cruel part rose that speaks to children only in grandmother's voice, when I saw I was repeating what I'd sworn to protect against, at that moment the explanation, the soul chose, stopped working. What soul? Why would a soul choose a mother who can't stroke her own belly? And I allowed a thought more frightening than all grandmother's curses. Maybe there is no soul. Maybe we live once. Maybe there was no meaning in this pain. No lesson, no plan, no choice. It just happened. Just bad luck. Just chaos, in which a child got what she got. And no one chose. And no one watches from above. And there's no one to turn to. And with this I lived, with an empty space where other people have faith. Only me. Only control. Only handle it yourself. Then my grandmother put me on my knees in the corner. And when 30 years later the AA program says, get on your knees and pray, the body recognizes it instantly. Same knees, same posture, same demand. Repent, admit you're bad, ask forgiveness from someone above. Before it was grandmother. Now, God, for my inner child there was no difference. And this guy at Dispenza says, you don't have to believe in God there. Your higher power can be anything. A group, nature, and the door that had been nailed shut since childhood. Cracked open, not flung wide. A crack, enough for air to seep through. I felt it in my chest as if something slightly unclenched. The second stranger who changed my life was also a former alcoholic. He stood before me, alive, calm, sober, with a great body, and said, why would I drink now when I can just breathe? And I believed him, not because he argued convincingly, but because he was standing, alive, a former alcoholic who no longer drinks, not because he conquered himself, not because he found God, but because he found another way to cope with what he used to drink from. Breathing. He showed me what he does, how he breathes, how through breathing he reaches the body, how through the body, feelings, how through feelings, the state Dispenza calls elevation, which I would later call more simply, when it's not empty inside. The next day, I quit drinking alcohol. Chapter A. Before this, I could drink a bottle of wine a day. Every other day, a bottle. I knew, if I continued, I'd die like my mother, like Uncle Oleg. Same organs, same method, same ending. Grandmother's curse fulfilling itself literally. Mother died. Oleg beaten to death while drunk. I'm next. And every time I poured myself wine, I knew this. And poured. I tried to quit. Couldn't. Not because I lacked willpower. Couldn't because wine wasn't the problem. Wine was the answer. The answer to pain that had no other exit. Therapist Oleg once said to me long ago, you don't have an alcohol problem. You have many other problems. I didn't understand then what he meant. Understood later. Alcohol wasn't the disease. It was anesthesia. The only working one. The only one that worked when nothing else did. And after the second Dispenza, after those two strangers who changed my whole life by the simple fact that they'd made it, I went to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. A specific problem, a specific goal, quit drinking. Simple, logical, like all my projects. Saw the task, solve it. Came to a meeting, sat, listened. AA didn't click. The format wasn't mine. People talked about binges, about hitting bottom, about losing everything. And I sat thinking, this isn't about me. I'm not an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. I just drink to survive. That's different. The resistance was powerful. My story is worse. This isn't my group. My body clenched at every meeting. Belonging means being vulnerable, and I didn't know how to do that. But in AA, I learned about ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholics. Not me, the alcoholic. My mother. And everything wrong with me isn't brokenness, but a pattern. I started going to meetings. For the first time, I saw my animals, not in the forest, but in other people's stories. Rabbit recognized someone else's rabbit. Fox, someone else's fox. Control nodded to control. Perfectionist met perfectionist, as if all these parts received confirmation for the first time. You're not the only one like this. And this isn't brokenness. This is what grows in houses like that. At the first ACA meeting, people told stories I knew from the inside. Beatings, expulsion, curses. They sat alive and said aloud what I'd been silent about for 35 years. not a thought, not an insight. Goosebumps on my arms and throat clenched. This is about me. I am the same. I have the same thing. And if they could, then so can I. The same mechanism that had worked before, saw that Valieva found her father, and started looking for mine, saw that these people in the room survived the same childhood, and believed I'd survive too. I always worked like that, saw what was possible for another, and took it as a benchmark for myself. Because believing in yourself directly, without example, without proof, without someone else's experience, I couldn't. The girl who was told from age 5, nobody needs you, doesn't believe herself. She believes facts, and someone else's survival story is a fact. Two paths converged, a CA, name it aloud, breathing, live it through the body, head and body, for the first time, together. These two gave direction, not a map, direction, not with words, with the fact of their existence. They stood alive. That was enough. I came home and began a CA every week, breathing every day, not because I believed it would help, but because after the knife, after 2 years of suicidal depression, after everything, I had no reasons left not to try. Nothing left to lose. The only thing remaining? Stubbornness. That same grandmother's. What she wants, she'll dig out from under the ground. Only now I wasn't digging out an A, not a visa, not a job. I was digging out myself, from under the rubble I'd buried myself in. All my time went to reflection, to breathing, to practices, to yoga, to ACA, to therapy, to inner work. I did Kundalini yoga, Joe Dispenza meditations, and breathing for 12 hours a day. Got up at 3 or 4 a.m. to do these practices every day. Vidya just said, I call you and all you do is breathe. I answered, I'm doing everything I can to restore the family. Preserving the family is the most important thing in my life right now. That's why I don't go anywhere. I do all these practices to calm down and restore love. I went to the Loving Parent Group in ACA. Many there lived in isolation like me. Four walls, closed door, phone on silent. I wanted to learn to go out, but meditation, breathing, and loving parent, this is what heals all these problems. I understood this from my own skin, not from a book, not from a therapist, from my own body, which for the first time in decades began to relax slightly. But the first year was a pit. Most of the time I was down. I didn't want to buy things, though I could. Didn't want to meet friends, see people, even when they called. I tensed up. Phone on do not disturb mode, so no one could even show a notification or call. I isolated myself within four walls, avoided everything. First 4 months of recovery and I see no progress. My hands drop. Again despair and isolation. How much longer? All my kind conversations with the critic and the perfectionist when they haven't captured me yet and I can still think. All that is only available when I'm alone. The moment another person appears, instant capture. Strong critic, skeptic, hellish fear of error from the perfectionist, all the fears. The time is passing wasted, inefficiently, we're wasting time. Well, all of that. But every time I had even a little good mood that year, and that was rare, like a break in solid clouds, I drove to the family and invested. Everything I'd gathered in the silence of my cell, every drop of warmth I'd managed to collect through breathing and meditations, I carried there. To them, I gave up all social events, focused only on the child, the house, work. This was my compensation. The eighth step of ACA suggested the main people I'd harmed are Arseny and Victor. There were practically no others. This is exactly what helped and continues to help preserve the family. This is truly the most important thing for me. I understood in meditations. My goal is to work on myself, improve my relationship with Victor and Arseny. If I die now, what am I living for? For this, for them, for us. And I constantly saw, I want to restore our relationship with Victor, with Arseny. I don't know whether it's codependency or real feelings. Because when things got really bad, in the pit, in despair, in hopelessness, I hated them all. Wanted them not to exist. Wanted to die myself. But when I climbed out even a little, when it let go even slightly, when breathing started working and the body relaxed a bit, I invariably drove to them, and the feelings were stable, precisely when I felt better. But codependency pulls down, and this pulled up. Here it was different. Each time, rising from the pit, I chose them. Not from despair, not because there's nowhere else to go, not because being alone is scary, but because when the fog cleared, they were what I saw, what I wanted to walk toward. It was a pendulum, from the pit to practice, from practice to family, from family back to the pit, from the pit back to the cell, and in circles, month after month. But each time, rising, I drove to them, and each time the feeling was the same. I want to go home. Want to go to my people. Each time the same. Warmth in my stomach when I turned toward home. The first stranger was a woman. Blonde, mid-50s. She stood at the microphone and said she'd been sober for 11 years. But sobriety was not the point. The point was what she said next. I was exactly where you are. And I got out. The second was a man, younger. He talked about breath work. How he'd started breathing, and his body began releasing what it had stored for decades. Tremors, screams, then calm, real calm. Not the kind you force, the kind that comes when something inside finally unclenches. Chapter A versus ACA. Why didn't AA work for me? In AA, people told their stories. Men and women who drank for years, lost families, jobs, homes, woke up in unfamiliar places, couldn't remember the night before. They said, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm powerless before alcohol. And the room nodded, and they continued, and I listened, and didn't recognize myself. Not because my story was easier. It was different. I didn't wake up in a ditch. I woke up in bed, went to work, earned a six-figure salary, won lawsuits for arseny, received exceeds high bar, and in the evening poured wine. Not to get drunk, to fall asleep, to not scream at the child. So the formula inside, all for nothing, nothing will change, no one will come, would shut up for at least an hour. I wasn't an alcoholic. But AA didn't see this difference. In AA, everyone is an alcoholic, period. In AA, you haven't drunk for 30 years. And still, I'm an alcoholic. Remission doesn't count, like the gold medal with grandmother. And the program is the same for everyone. Admit powerlessness, trust God, do the steps, attend meetings. 30 years sober, attend. 40 years, attend. Until the end of life, attend and repent. I sat watching people who hadn't had a drop in 30 years. We are still introducing themselves. I'm an alcoholic. 30 years and still repenting. Still bad. Still guilty. And something inside me rebelled. Not protest and recognition. Because I knew this model. I grew up in it. Grandmother, you're guilty. You're bad. You must repent. Stand on your knees until you ask forgiveness. And AA was offering me the same thing, in different packaging. Eternal repentance, eternal guilt, eternal I'm not good enough. No thanks. I already lived in that for 40 years. I'd had enough. And one more thing. In AA, they examine what you did wrong, whom you harmed, before whom you're guilty. Did an inventory, the fourth step, but didn't examine why. Didn't dig to the root. Didn't ask, where did this come from? Where did this bottle come from? Where did this powerlessness come from? What happened in childhood? What was done to you before you started doing this to yourself? Hurt people wasn't discussed. AA treated the symptom, alcohol, but didn't touch the cause, the pain they drank from, And the solution, the only solution AA offered, was trust the higher power. God, surrender control. And for some people, it worked. For people who could believe, for people who had some notion that the world could be safe, that someone above cares, that you can let go and not fall. But I was the girl who prayed for her mother to come back, and mother didn't come back. What God, the one who punishes children, the one you pray to on your knees like grandmother put you in the corner. My inner child doesn't believe in God, can't. Not because I'm an atheist, because every time he trusted something bigger than himself, he was betrayed. My sponsor from ACA would later tell me, "You don't have to believe. It's enough to be willing to believe. Willing to believe. That's already a step." And this changed everything. Because willing to believe isn't a demand for blind faith. It's permission to doubt. And doubting I could do since birth. AA didn't click. I admitted it, not easily. Because admitting that yet another attempt didn't work was one more piece of evidence. Nothing helps. But I admitted it and left. And then, in AA, ironically, I learned about ACA. Adult Children of Alcoholics. Not me, the alcoholic. Not me, the problem. My mother was the alcoholic, and I grew up in it, and everything happening to me, control, perfectionism, inability to relax, inability to feel, inability to ask, inability to trust, isn't my personal defect. It's the reaction of a child who grew up in a dysfunctional family. It has a name, it has a description, it has other people who've been through it. I came to my first ACA meeting and heard three rules that took my breath away. Three rules of the alcoholic family I grew up in. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. My entire life, me in three words. Don't tell the truth. Grandmother will punish. Don't trust anyone. Everyone will betray. Don't feel. Feelings hurt too much. Better numbness. I live by these rules from birth. I didn't know they existed as a formulation. I didn't know other people live by them too. I thought it was just life. My life. Normal. And there. A room. People. Who survived hell? The same as mine. Beatings. Expulsion. Control. Curses. Silence. Loneliness. And they sat. Alive. And said aloud what I'd been silent about for 40 years. And the most important thing. They didn't just survive. They crossed the river that Joe Dispenza often talks about. They stood on the other bank and said, "There is light here. It's dim. You don't see it right away. But it's there." I learned about reparenting, about how inside every adult child of an alcoholic lives a small child no one raised. And the task is not to find the perfect parent outside, there won't be one, but to grow one inside. Become your own mother. Become your own father. Talk to yourself in a kind voice. Notice yourself. Comfort. Praise. Protect. Everything grandmother didn't do. Everything mother didn't do. Everything grandfather wanted to but couldn't. And here's the difference with AA, huge, fundamental. In AA, the solution is God. Surrender to him. Trust. In ACA, the solution is you. Grow an inner parent. Become what you never had. Don't wait for someone to come and save you. Become that someone for yourself. Don't count on a higher power. Become your own higher power. Through meditation, through breathing, through the kind voice, through daily, monotonous, boring work, like everything that truly changes a life. For me, thorough, analytical, not one to take things on faith. This was the only thing that could work. Not believe, but do. Not surrender control, but learn to control differently, from inside, not outside. Not you're powerless, but you're stronger than you think. You've just been directing the strength in the wrong direction. The ACA book became my Bible. Not because I found God or because I found myself, the little one, the one who stood in the corner on her knees, the one who at 6 months lay in a crib and waited. She hadn't gone anywhere. She simply waited, 40 years, for someone to come and say, "I'm here. I won't leave. You're not alone." And that someone, strangely enough, turned out to be me. The biggest breakthrough began when I broke the rules. Don't talk. I started talking. Aloud. At meetings. In my journal. In this book. Don't trust. I started trusting. First, the group. Then, a sponsor. Then, a little, myself. Don't feel, I started feeling. And that ripped open every wound. All of them. At once. As if I'd opened a hatch under which 40 years of what I'd hidden had been accumulating. And it all poured out. Pain, hatred, shame, guilt, grief, anger, despair. Longing for the mother who isn't there. Anger at the grandmother who exists only in memory. It all poured out. And I drowned in it. And fell. And rose. And fell again. But that was the salvation. Not in the falling. And the fact that I was falling and rising differently now, not mechanically, not on autopilot, not because I had to, but because I chose to. For the first time, for myself, for that little girl inside who waited 40 years for someone to come for her. I came, not mother, not grandmother, not Vitya, not God, me, the knees remember grandmother's corner. But I got up from them myself. And this was the beginning of what I would later call transformation. This was not an insight. I'd had many insights. This was different. For the first time since childhood, I sat in a room and wasn't alone in my abnormality. Not everyone around is normal, I'm not. But there are several of us. There are many of us. And we're all alive. Not healing. Simply, for the first time, not alone with it. In AA, I found a name. In ACA, a map. The 12 steps are not a healing program. They are a program of honesty. First with yourself. Then with those you love. Then with everything else. I started with the first. It was the most impossible. When I first read the characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, all 14 points, I didn't cry. I laughed. Nervously, briefly, like a person who'd been searching for a diagnosis for 40 years and suddenly found it in one paragraph. For the first time in my life, my defect turned out to be not unique. For the first time, not alone. Chapter Broken Dishes. After the ashram and finding myself, I came to Arseny for the weekend feeling uplifted. I dreamed. I could come back. We'd get a dog. I'd devote time to family, stop working so much, everything would be fine. I was doing 3 hours of practices a day, breathing, shaking, rocking the inner child, 3 hours a day every day. I was certain, I'm ready. It lasted 50 minutes. He shoved me, screamed, insulted me, then smashed all the dishes, wrecked the kitchen, everything he could get his hands on, plates, cups, glasses. The sound of breaking dishes, like grandmother's voice, sharp, sudden, making everything inside clench. Before I would have stopped him, grabbed him, pinned him to the floor by force, or screamed back, in that same grandmother's voice that made me shudder for hours afterward, or run to the bathroom and sat there shaking. But this time, for the first time, I didn't stop him. Simply removed from the danger zone anything that could hurt, and stood nearby. Silent, not angry, not screaming, not clenching my teeth. All my practices helped. 3 months of breathing, kundalini, meditations, talking to the inner child. 3 months I taught the body not to react the old way, and the body obeyed. For the first time, he wrecked everything and stopped. Not because I stopped him, because he ran out of fuel. Because for the first time an adult stood nearby who didn't answer fire with fire, who didn't become another source of screaming, who simply was. Then I explained to him, calmly as never before, "You were probably angry at me for living apart from you, for leaving, for the small apartment instead of a house with a pool. You have the right to be angry. You're in pain. I see that." He cried. The next day the episode repeated. I held steady again. Then I fell apart. Not him. Me. I crumbled inside, as if I'd held a building on my back while he was smashing. And when he left, the building collapsed on me. For a month, I couldn't see him. Couldn't visit. Cried for hours. Couldn't work. The part that held let go. And underneath it was empty. Vitya added to it, said, "You've been doing your practices for a month and a half, and there's no result. You're just as bad. Go to the gym, do a cold plunge, get a hobby, and everything will be fine. What you're doing is all crap." I sat and cried and tried to kill the hope that I'd ever return to that house, because I didn't want to come where I get screamed at. I was tired of reviving this hope, wanted to kill it for good, but didn't know how to live without it. And then, a month later, something happened that I didn't expect. They prescribed him medication after that incident, and it started helping. For the first time, we'd tried everything over 4 years. On the weekend, when Vitya was building a sauna and I had to be with Arseny, he didn't scream once. Not once. Before we had this. One day in 3 months, he doesn't scream. One day without screaming was a good day. A holiday. We marked it internally, the way you mark remission. And here, 2 days in a row, Vitya saw changes, too, throughout that month. And what struck me most wasn't the medication. The medication helped. But the coincidence was too precise. Things started changing when I started working on myself. And when I allowed him to do what he was doing, not stopped, not screamed, not run away, just allowed. As if for 10 years he had been waiting not for my control, not for my screaming, not for my instructions and correct words from books. He was waiting for an adult to stand beside him who wouldn't crumble from his pain. Who could endure without answering fire with fire? Of course, I need more days like that to stop being afraid to come and spend time with him. This isn't healing yet. This is the first exhale after 10 years of holding your breath. But he didn't scream. 2 days. And that was like a miracle. A small, quiet, ugly miracle, preceded by broken dishes and a month when I couldn't get off the floor.